So now we have some more questions. But today is Thursday, and tomorrow is Friday, and tomorrow evening I will be giving the talk at Dhammaloka Center in Nolamara. So the questions tomorrow will be for the sisters. So now you can ask them what they've been doing on this retreat. Ask them all the interesting questions. So that's tomorrow. Ask the nuns. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, I saw you during my meditation. That's very nice. Smiling and basking in bliss in a reclining position in front of a huge red-orange crystal waterfall. I think this is good enough proof. That what? Who knows? But anyway, it's so nice you saw me smiling and basking in bliss in a reclining position in front of a huge red-orange crystal. Are you sure it wasn't in front of a fish and chip shop? No, a waterfall is more appropriate to meditation. Sometimes you do get these images in the mind, but don't take them seriously. It's just a nice sign you're getting peaceful in meditation and something's inspiring you. So very good. Next question. Ajahn, could you please elaborate on that obscure paragraph in the Upakalesa Sutta where the Buddha explains to Anuruddha on what to do on the Nimitta Jhana boundary, where you get strong light but not forms, and the light and wrap around occur very fast and very strongly. Please, had a huge explosion of bliss, sadness at this point, and I'm still picking up the pieces. Okay, what to do on the Nimitta and Jhana boundary? There's a lot of stuff which the Buddha said there, but the main problems is fear and excitement when you really get into deep states of meditation. So we be careful of getting afraid. It's quite natural. Even the Buddha got afraid. That's why he said in the Mahasachaka Sutta, just before he became enlightened, why should I be afraid of that pleasure which has nothing to do with the sensory world? He said, I will not be afraid. And then he became a Buddha. So if you got afraid, if that was one of the reasons why it all sort of disappeared, you are walking in the footsteps of the Buddha. He got afraid too. So don't feel down upon yourself. But after a while, what are you afraid of? It's always afraid of losing something. All fear is you're about to lose something which you think you own, which you think is part of you, which you're attached to. So fear is a great precursor for insight, and especially for letting go to another deeper stage. So if fear comes up, it's a good thing because it's showing you, yeah, you're attached to something and it's about to lose it. That's why fear is. Fear is about impending loss of something or other. So you're about to lose something. So you think, what am I going to lose? Lose my body? Lose my will? Brilliant. Go for it. It's worth it. I recommend it. So you overcome fear by examining what you're afraid of losing and realizing you don't own it anyway. And it's better gone than kept. So, just a little bit of reflection, and then fear disappears. As for excitement, again, it's nothing to do with you. You haven't got these nimittas. It's not your attainment. It's just these things happen. When there's a traveller, then there'll be excitement. So see if you can be a meditator who's not a traveller. So, both of those problems of fear and excitement, the big two problems which stop people going deep into meditation, is all over. Well, a great way of overcoming it is just to do more reflections on non-self. You know, what do you own anyway? So, you know, when you're doing walking meditation, if you get nice and peaceful, then do some reflections on anatta. You know, who's doing walking anyway? Who owns this old body of mine? And, you know, what is this world anyway? And do enough reflections. You really get that anatta idea so closely and deeply in your mind, which means that when you get to that boundary, fear, what's to fear? Got nothing to lose. Excitement, nothing to do with me. And that anatta, non-self reflection, really strengthens the mind in letting go. So the fear and excitement just do not come up at all. And then you get that bliss, and it stays. Obviously, you got the sadness, because you had the bliss, you're almost there, and you blew it again. Oh, dear. You've only got 1.5 days left. Are you going to be able to get it back again? Is this going to be too late? So, actually, I did hear that people have been talking about, I think I mentioned the other day, about 2012, the world's going to end. So how many more retreats can we have? Towards 2010, we've got another one this year, two in 2011. When in 2012 is it going to end? 21st of December. Okay, so we've got quite a few more retreats yet, 5 more retreats. So no need to worry at all. So this is actually what happens. You've got strong light and you just got that bit afraid. Or excited, one of those two. And all the other those, I think 12 will pick a laser, 12 of these little, they're all just pretty similar to fear and excitement, one way or another. So just calm down, just relax. And do some perceptions of non-self, and it makes it life much easier.
Arjun?
Yeah. Was it 12, wasn't it? I don't know. Yeah. It's very. It's very difficult to understand exactly what he meant by that, but it probably is similar to the fact that sometimes people get this like screen of light, very brilliant, but it's not sort of like the like a form like a star or like a sort of like a sun. And of course, you know, really what you want is like the sun. It's very, very bright. So those two together is where you really get sort of the stuff which will lead you into the deeper nimittas and the greater jhanas. Beautiful light, very powerful, and you know, has almost like a form to it, a shape to it. That, you know, just you just have to go through your own experience and just what the heck did the Buddha mean by this, because he doesn't give any explanation. So you have to sort of work out from your own experience what that could mean.
So it's a matter of just going to that place again and again and playing
with it. Until your nimitta gets very strong and focused. Consolidate, focused. Because sometimes if there is like a whole screen of light, it means that, yeah, you've got a powerful mind, but it's losing its focus. It's just too spread out. So it can't get intensity. Of course, you've, you know, heard me say some of the tricks. If you have got this really smeared bit of light, if you could train your mind beforehand, just because, right, basically I just give you the suggestion right now and it works for you. If you have that screen of light, there'll always be one part of it which is brighter and more brilliant than the next. And so your mind goes to that. So it focuses in on the nice stuff, the sweet part of that nimitta. And then that sort of tends to sort of expand. You go to the sweeter part of that, which means that the nimitta gets brighter and brighter until it gets, you know, the real strong, bright nimittas. You know, the brilliant sort of star-type nimittas. That's one way of dealing with it, always going to the more beautiful. And one way of training in that is like developing the perception of the beautiful rather than the fault-finding mind. And this is actually something which you know that sort of I taught Anolamara many, many times. I teach the monks this. The fault-finding mind is something which is generated in our modern life, always seeing the faults and therefore the problems, and thereby fixing up the problems. That's what your job is, a manager, you know, a therapist. You see the problems in a person, you think you fix them up. So there's always that fault finding, seeing the problems. However, that we develop a different type of attitude and perceptions. We put aside the faults and we look at the sort of the strong points, the beautiful points. So when you're in this meditation retreat center, you know, you can look around and see all the things which are wrong, all the things which should be fixed up. That's the fault finding mind. Or you can look upon the beautiful parts of this retreat center, you know, how magnificent it is. You've got the choice there to look at the beautiful or the faulty. And because most of us have been trained to always pick up the faults, you have to almost make a deliberate effort to change and look at the beauty and have things like gratitude and just appreciation. And if you can do that while you're in this retreat center, you find that when you get to stages of light nimitta, quite naturally you're always going towards the beautiful part of the nimitta rather than its faults. And that is incredibly helpful to get into the jhanas. If you look for the faults, yeah, there might be a faulty part of the nimitta somewhere, but you're not looking at that, you're looking at the beautiful part. You're always inclining towards the beauty, towards the bright, and you're not so fault-finding. And some of the monks tell me I developed that just over the top because I don't find faults in anybody. And they said, you should be a bit more critical of us monks. And they say that with a very beautiful sort of attitude. I say, no, because this is just how I train myself. Sometimes I just respect you all. And I just deliberately can't see your faults because I've trained myself not to do that. And that really works well in getting into deep meditations. So I think that's one of the upeklesas which you can overcome by that method. Is that okay? Okay. Great. Yes? Yeah, this. Yeah, there are two things to look out for when you're cultivating the nimitta stage. And in the Anapanasati Sutta, they make it very clear. It's like Abhipamojayang Jitang and Samadahang Jitang. Abhipamojayang means literally brighten it up. And so when I was talking now about developing the gratitude mind, looking for the beauty in something, that's actually a wonderful technique to actually brighten up the nimitta, make it brighter and more powerful and more beautiful. Oh, lovely. But the strategy of just looking at the watcher and just calming the watcher down, that is what is a very powerful method for Samadahang Jitang, for stilling the nimitta. Because there's two things you have to do. Keep the nimitta totally still, so it's not moving at all, and allow it to sort of get brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter. So if you've got a beautiful, brilliant nimitta, but it's just moving around too much, then that technique of just putting attention in the watcher so the watcher is still works very, very well. But if the nimitta is still and it's not bright enough yet, then the technique of just seeing the beautiful parts of the nimitta really help. And some of you already, like the person who said they saw a picture of me smiling and basking in bliss in a reclining position in front of a huge red-orange crystal waterfall. If you have a nimitta like that, beautiful, but don't go to all the details. There'll be some part of that nimitta, especially waterfall, which is sparkling. And if you can just go to that sparkling part of that nimitta, the whole screen there, go to the sparkling, the beautiful part. And because it's a really beautiful part, that will actually grow in your sort of mind's eye. And very often turn into a beautiful nimitta. So you look at the sparkle, like the dewdrop on the leaf, which is reflecting the sun. And that just blossoms into a full-on deep nimitta. It's another skillful means of taking sort of a complicated nimitta of a whole vision and turning into the nimittas which will take you into the jhanas. Look at the sparkle, the beautiful part. That's what works. Yeah, to answer the question, yeah.
So there is those two parts that we have to do, but would it still work if we just keep still?
It does work if you keep still, because the stillness gives you more and more energy and it brightens it up. But it's almost like a shortcut to find the beautiful part. Yeah. Because we all like shortcuts. I like shortcuts too. You've got to be careful. It's a proper shortcut. You're not going to waste time. It works. Okay, another question. Yeah.
Can I just ask you, you said, I think, in one of your books about the nimitta can be feeling in the body?
Ah, feeling nimittas. Feeling nimittas, yeah, they're valid, but they're very hard to deal with. That's why we usually like to sort of use the light nimittas. It's much easier for you to work with, to develop and take them into the jhanas. Because these aren't physical feelings, these aren't lights you see with your eyes. This is a mental phenomenon. And the reason why most people see those nimittas as so-called lights is because most people are very developed in their visual perceptions. So there we have a mental thing, and what happens is that we have to try and understand it for ourselves. And the way we understand it, we try and find something similar from our ordinary life. What is this experience similar to? And for most people, it's similar to a beautiful light, simply because we are visual and beautiful. And because it's not a light, but that is the nearest thing which you can use to describe it to yourself. So that's actually how it appears to your perception. And it's not a physical light. The eyes aren't working. The sense of sight is totally turned off. It's a mental phenomena, a mental image. But we interpret it as light.
Feeling in the body,
if it's the nimitta stage, the body's totally disappeared. It can be a feeling, but it's a disembodied feeling. A feeling of like pleasure, of bliss. But it's not located in the body. If it comes on fast, it usually disappears fast.
Yes.
So you want it to sort of develop slowly. So these things, they develop, but what it is, it's exactly the same experience as those who see the light. But, you know, your perception is experiencing it as similar to the physical pleasure. But it's much, it's good advice to try and develop the visual ones, because the feely ones are really difficult to work with. The light ones, you've got more sort of more techniques, more gadgets, more sort of things you can actually use on the light nimittas, which is why the light nimittas are the ones which most people use to take them into jhanas. If you manage to fluke a jhana for the feeling nimitta, great, marvelous. But I really encourage you to sort of start interpreting those feelings as lights, because you have a much easier chance to, a much easier progress to develop the jhanas and maintain them using the light nimittas. Exactly, yeah. And you don't really have to work very hard to convert it, because it's just perception. It's just you're telling perception to compare it to a light rather than compare it to a feeling. And it can do that just with ease. It can switch just as with no problem at all. Because it's not a light, it's not a feeling. It's a mental object. But it's because we just do not have the language or the perceptual framework to understand this pure mental world. We have to borrow language from the world of the five senses. There we go. But when you get these nimittas, you get into them. And this is a fascinating place for insight. You understand how all this perception works and just why you sort of perceive it this way and not another way. It's fantastic, the world of perception. And sometimes we're just so locked into one way of perceiving. So when you get into that nimitta stage, your perception is really freeing up. You're understanding how it all works. Regarding the simile you gave of the match and the gunpowder, how important is it that the gunpowder, the Dhamma teachings, come from an Aryan? Isn't it enough to read suttas or hear teaching from a teacher who may not be an Aryan but is clear and seems accurate, agreed with suttas and other teachers? What is the extra oomph getting teachings from an Aryan gives? Just psychological value, inspires more faith, etc., or is there really some cool actual mental transmission involved? Now, it's nothing sort of psychic. All it is that, yeah, you can read those suttas, and the suttas are pretty accurate, but even so, people can read those suttas and still get the totally sort of wrong way of understanding them. What happens these days is people actually spend too much time reading the commentaries rather than the suttas. So if you actually just read the suttas, we've got pretty good translations of them now. They're not perfect, but they're reasonably good. So if you read the suttas, it gives you much more of an idea. But you get something like, you know, even just the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations. You know, when you start talking about Vitaka Vichara, still they put stupid things like, thinking and sort of contemplation or whatever. So it's very nice to really see it deeply for yourself, and then you understand exactly what these are. So if you've actually been into jhanas, you know there's no thinking in there. So you know that word can't mean sort of thinking. So if you've got some experience, the suttas can come alive. So that's why it's really lovely to have them from someone who knows what they're talking about. But nevertheless, some people actually say that those teachings from the suttas are enough. Because, you know, they are from the Aryan, from the Buddha himself. So at least get some basic understanding of the teaching from the suttas. And as I said the other day, just don't just read one sutta, your favorite sutta, and just base all of your Buddhism on just one sutta. Just read widely, and then you find it sort of meshes into a seamless whole. And you get the idea of, you know, the basic teachings of Buddhism, which pervade from sutta after sutta after sutta after sutta. The repetition is there for a purpose. And it reinforces the underlying message of, you know, Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. So if you read those suttas, little sayings like this still comes up by some, even monks, you know, that the only way to sort of enlightenment is satipatthana. I mean, that's totally wrong. It's both the sutta doesn't say that, and also it contradicts everything else which is said in the Pali Canon. So the only way to become enlightened is the Eightfold Path. It says that so many times. That's the way to enlightenment. That's the path. So the only way to become enlightened is Eightfold Path. So you have to keep the Eightfold Path. So it's not just mindfulness, it's not just satipatthana, you've got to keep your precepts as well, otherwise it don't work. So when you actually read the whole suttas, all these sort of little sayings by some monks just fall away, you actually see it for yourself. So yeah, that is good enough gunpowder. But you've got to keep reading and reading and just get the overview. An Aryan is a stream winner, once returned, or non-returned, or arahat. Someone has actually seen the Dhamma, so they know what they're talking about. Rather than just saying what my teacher said or what the book says. Dear Ajahn, my mind is starting to get still more easily as the days go by. Much thanks. Just wanted to ask, how can I tell if this stillness was through thoughts or through natural reasons? I can't tell, at least out my reasoning. If it's still, it can't be through force. Because force cannot produce that real stillness, that beautiful, peaceful, that soft, lovely stillness. So if that's, you've got a sort of stillness, but it's hard, like, you know, just like a rock and tough, and that's not real stillness. The real stillness has got a lot of metta with it. So how you can tell, like the simile this morning, if metta the dog is traveling with you on your journey, and Metta the dog is getting happier and happier as Sam Atta, Mr. Stillness, and Vipassana, Mrs. Wisdom, are getting higher and higher up the mountain, then you know, yeah, you're getting somewhere. So it's not just stillness, more clarity of mind, seeing more Dhamma, and also Metta and happiness. They have to come along. So if you've just got stillness, there's no Metta there at all. That's probably through force. But if you've got stillness and just beautiful happiness and kindness, so you're so still, if someone takes the last ice cream, you think, may you be happy and well. You don't get at all upset because you're still and you're also happy. Okay? So that means you're really getting still. Yeah, got lots of kindness. Here we go. Nibbana is, but not the person that enters it. Does it just mean that cessation is possible happy? Whatever that means. This statement can easily be misinterpreted and imagined Nibbana being something outside the five khandhas. So it'd be good if you can please clarify that statement. In a sense, Nibbana is outside the five khandhas because five khandhas have stopped. There's nothing outside the five khandhas, and that's what Nibbana is. They had this wonderful simile of the flame. And this is from the Agawachi Gotu Sutta. This is Buddha's teachings. He said, just like there is a flame, and that flame is dependent upon three causes. The wick is cause number one. The oil is cause number two. And the heat is cause number three. And if somebody takes that one of those causes away, the wick is all used up. The oil is exhausted. Or the wind takes the heat away. Then the flame ceases. And the Buddha asks Vajragotha, where does the flame go? He said, does it go east, west, north, south? Or does it go to the unconditioned realm where all flames exist in a sort of half existence? Does it go to the heaven where all good flames live happy ever after. Where does that flame go once it goes out? And Vasugo said, what are you talking about? It doesn't go anywhere. It's just gone out, that's all. Exactly. This thing we call a person is just dependent upon five causes, five khandhas, the body, feeling, perception, mental formations, mostly will, and consciousness. One of those disappears, you've gone out. Where did you go? You go nowhere. It's just five causes coming together. You take that to be you. The causes disappear. Finished. And nothing's been destroyed because there was nothing there to begin with. It's just a flame is not sort of self-existent. It's just a combination of these three causes. Oil, wick, and heat. That's what a flame is. So once one of those causes go, so does everything else. So once things like will or consciousness stop, that's it. Nothing left. Poof. Vanished. Ceased. Nibbanaed. And that's actually was the word. I always say this, that if you read those ancient Buddhist teachings in Pali, you come across an interesting insight. Every villager, even small boy, would understand exactly what the meaning of Nibbana was. Because it was a word in common usage. It was the word which used when the flame went out. So if someone had an oil lamp and it went out, the kid would say, Mummy, Mummy, the flame is Nibbana'd. And they know exactly what it meant. It just gone out. And so the Buddha was using Nibbana. It was a word in common usage. It wasn't some metaphysical word which had a meaning all by itself. It was a word which everybody knew the meaning of. It went out, finished, gone. However, people don't like that explanation because they say, look, I meditated so hard. I gave all this dana, I kept all these precepts, and now I did everything and got these jhanas and became enlightened. What you mean? Now I just go out, I can't enjoy Nibbana once I've got it. Exactly. So it's all gone, finished. That's what Ajahn Chah said. Remember the story that when he asked me why, and he said there's nothing there? And do you understand? Do you understand? No, you don't. So that's what Nibbana is. And it's amazing just how people resist. Well, it's really obvious. They resist that because, no, please, I don't want to disappear. Can I just keep a tiny bit of me somewhere? Just a smidgen of me, just some sort of original mind or some sort of merging with the Absolute or something, because I don't want to go. And that's called bhava dhanha, the craving to be, which is one of the things which stops people becoming enlightened. You don't want to give yourself up. So when it said the person is, sorry, Nibbana is not the person who enters it, now you understand, it's a brilliant saying. You just vanish. And just as you vanish, Nibbana exists. If you're still there, sorry, Nibbana isn't there. It's the Anatta doctrine. And it's only when you realize that this thing you take to be a self, what is? Who the hell do you think you are? Who are you anyway? Who do you take yourself to be? You're not Sri Lankan Gupta. You're not English, Diane. You're not a girl. You're not a boy. You're not someone from Penang. You're not old. You're not young. That's just your stupid body. So never think your body has anything to do with you. So let's put that aside pretty quickly. So else is you, your mind. What do you mean by your mind? The two parts of your mind, the doer, the will, and the consciousness. Is that what you really are? Are you the one behind all this willing? Did you really choose to come here? Did you choose to put your finger in your ear to get the wax out, Chris? Did you really choose to eat this food and not other food? Feels like that, doesn't it? Because that's one of the places you really think you are. I am this thing behind the will. I am the person at the controls of my life. That is a total delusion. The Buddha said that. You've heard me say that before. You go into Sakakanjana and you'll see that perfectly clearly. And that just shocks you. I mean, that's a big shock. Because it's counterintuitive beforehand. It's totally obvious afterwards. I remember in Singapore years ago, it was Soon Han. He sort of, I think he was the president that year, one of the Singaporeans. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, we've had enough about two bad bricks and opening the door of your heart and all these stories. Can you really give us a deep deep Dhamma talk? So you want a deep one? He said, yeah, I want a deep one. So I told him about non-self. And he, the following morning he complained, he said, Ajahn Brahm, I never slept all night. Don't do that again. Because it is actually fearsome. And it even says in the Buddha, they said some monks, when the Buddha starts teaching about non-self, get afraid. Why afraid? Well, I said earlier, because you're about to lose something you cherish most of all. You. Your will, ability to control. This is really amazing stuff. Once you let that go, oh, it's incredible freedom. When you know not your will, you're not so responsible anymore. You can mess around and play around. Because you don't judge yourself. What was my fault? I told a stupid joke. Didn't have any choice. Not me. I'm totally irresponsible. So that's what happens when your will is regarded as not you. So you get to the will is not you, and the last thing of all, your consciousness, the knower, the one who knows. And the trouble is that as you go deep into the jhanas, that vanishes, it fades away. That's the whole purpose of from first jhana, second jhana onwards. First jhana, your body disappears. Second jhana, your will disappears. And the further jhanas, your consciousness disappears. Especially in the immaterial realms. It just gets more and more hard to think there's anything there. It vanishes. And you realize your consciousness, your knower, your mind is anicca. Subject to sensation. Subject to stopping. Not a permanent thing. Not the seat of your soul. It's just consciousness, that's all. Just knowing, but nothing to do with me. You've got nothing left. When you've got nothing left, you've got no worries. When you've got no worries, you're free. So that's what happens. Everything vanishes and disappears. And there's absolutely nothing left. So that was actually the thing which distinguished the Buddha's teachings from all other religious teachings. Nothingness, non-self. Others always sort of stopped, oh yeah, union with the Brahman, that's just the first jhana experience. You haven't really disappeared yet. But this is total vanishing. Not even David Copperfield could vanish like the Buddha could. He still has something left. The Buddha, nothing left at all. Isn't that wonderful? I love that. However, some people say, no, it can't be. But it is. Anyway, any comments about that? Well, I thought we'd get some. Yeah. Go on, Gupta, you're first. Yeah.
What knows about that?
It doesn't. All the knowing stops as well. Vanishes. So once you get parinibbana, you don't know it. It's gone, finished. So that's why you can't enjoy it when it happens. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. You nibbana, the flame doesn't know it's gone out. It's gone out. Does that make any does that help at all? Not really. Yes, probably. Dependent origination is all stopped. When avijja stops, everything else stops. No more birth, no more coming into being. No more old age, sickness and death. No more nappies, no more going to school. No more gut ache. Oh, freedom at last. No more getting married. No more having sex. No more getting headaches when you don't want sex. No more. I don't know if that happens. That's what just read in the newspapers. So I don't know what happens in your lives. But whatever. It's all gone. Finish. Sip. Okay, nirvana means you've got no more craving for existence left. All of those things which created rebirth has totally disappeared. So you said like the workmen waiting for their wages. You've done the job, but the paycheck hasn't come yet. So you've still got your five candles going, but they're fatally, terminally wounded. So you just carry on until your death. And at the death of the body, there's nothing which is left to create a new birth. Parinibbana. Nibbana is actually the cessation of the causes of rebirth. Things like craving, attachments, greed, hatred, delusion, basically. Stop totally. They've nibbana'd. And a parinibbana was everything else nibbana's as well. Total cessation. That's what pari means, like all around, total. Total cessation. Oh, because he was just the Buddha, just the number one. So he gave him an extra maha on top of his parinibbana. That's all. Nothing really much greater than that. Yes? Dania, and then Michael afterwards, yeah?
So you know how you say the prague, or is it inference?
Okay, tiny bit of inference, but you got the experience that it's disappearing and disappearing, and 90% of it's disappearing, and you're really peaceful and blissed out. And it's pretty easy to see the last 10% when they disappear, it also goes.
As consciousness disappears,
then you get.
But you can't experience like.
Well, you do, you see it just go. Pop.
Okay.
Just the very end when it disappears, and you disappear too.
But that's why when you say it touches.
Yeah, that's good, yeah. That's why they say this is in those progress of the jhanas and immaterial states. They say you experience the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, the first immaterial, second immaterial, third immaterial, fourth immaterial. But then they change the word to the cessation of all perception and feeling. You don't experience that. You can't. It's nothing there to experience. You're gone. You say you touch it. Poof, and you're vanished. It's a very nice little change in the Pali terms, which you notice. Now, why did they change the word? Why did the Buddha use a different word? Because you don't experience a cessation of things. I mean, a total cessation. You just vanish. Okay, I mean, look, people are just thinking about this, so we're not getting any more questions going on. So, two more questions, and then we finish. So, Mark, you had your hand up first, and then Cheng. When did we appear? Who knows? I don't know. So I know you came to monastery a few months ago. And that's all I know. Before then, who cares? If you're mindful sharp enough, remember you don't just have mindfulness. Every of the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path are necessary. Mindfulness by itself is not enough. You need jhana as well. You need all the other factors. Well, Porsche, where did that come from?
when does the consciousness go into
the body? It can be many times. It can go into the body. It can just before the fetus is born. So actually, if that consciousness hasn't descended into the body yet, it's not a separate being. So you're not killing anybody. Yeah. So if you get some psychic to have a look in there and says, has the consciousness descended yet, and it hasn't, then fine, no worries. But if you're not sure, you may make a big mistake. Anyway, what are you worried about that for? You're a man. Okay, Cheng, last question. awareness, yeah.
You really will know that you're so really the thinking completely stopped.
That's right, yeah. So
you and I think if you really got into that kind of experience, all this kind of talking will have stopped during this retreat.
Okay.
Very
good. It is, because people like thinking about it. Okay, I agree with you. No. Next question. Why is it difficult to let go of sense of self and attachment even though they are suffering? Because you don't see them as suffering. You think, if I get it right, if I'm wise enough, then I can live this life without any suffering. Just next time, make sure you choose your husband properly. Get sort of a good model rather than a faulty model. Or maybe you can change your lifestyle next time. You know, you get born and get sort of born as like a wealthy person. You don't have to go to work. And so, you know, you can, instead of having just one husband, you can have like a whole harem of boys. You can choose which one you want. You know, this for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and you can go to the shop and change them if you don't like them. So I don't know what people have the idea of what they think is heaven is, but that's what most people think. If we work really hard and we're smart, we can work it so we don't have any suffering. That's why I think, if I win the lotto, if I get that Powerball, I'll be happy forever after. Oh, if you will accept my hand in marriage and love me forever after, oh, I'll be happy forever after. People always think the happy ever after. It never happens, of course. But people always hope. I remember meeting this one lady, I think she was about 50, and she told me, she said, I know he's out there somewhere. He's out there somewhere, I just haven't met him yet. My soulmate, the love of my life. 50, and she's still dumb. So, the point of the matter is that people just, they want to be happy so much that they live in hope. And it's hopelessness. And after a while, you sort of find out, you sort of clue in. Just, it's having that sense of self and attachment, that's the suffering. So you can't do anything about it. It's fatally flawed, except just let it all go. So when you actually see what the real problem is, then you don't get attached to self. You don't get attached to things anymore. Why on earth would you? So any real insight, if it's a real insight, you lose attachments. And your ego just goes down, down, down. It just starts fading very quickly. Real insights. Dear Bhante, I felt that there are lots of pressure in monastic life. It's pressure on my bottom, all this sitting. Pressure on my ears, all these questions. The expectation from the lay monastic is very high and seems like no room for mistakes, e.g. your excommunication. You can handle it well, but most people are average, not most people, average person. Is it worth the effort of being a monastic? Of course it is. You've got much more pressure than I have. You've got to worry about getting up early in the morning and going to work. You've got to worry about looking smart. I don't have to worry if my robe falls off. There's a patch on it if it's dirty. You have to worry about your health care and superannuation. I don't have to worry about that. I've got none of it. So actually, people expect you to be perfect or whatever, but you know, even I'm not perfect. I pick my nose sometimes, and actually quite often. And it's wonderful, actually, just think, I don't care what you think. I'm going to pick my nose. What's wrong with picking your nose? It's a natural thing. So it's a great being a monk. You can do all these sort of things and you just don't give a damn. You can tell stupid jokes and you can tell them again and again, even though you know people have heard them, because they respect you so much they won't really complain. Maybe they're complaining under their breath. So you get a great deal of freedom being a monk. And the thing is that you learn to be much more happy and more free. Yeah, you're not perfect, but you're much closer to perfection. I'm not talking about, you know, ideas of perfection in the world, but you're more close to the inner perfection of just being free and being content. So that's why people love being monastics. So for you it may seem hard, but for me it looks like you live the hard life. And for the life of me, I can't see why more of you just don't join up as being a monastics. It's much more fun. It's much more freedom. You have much more joy. No more worries. Anyway, I believe that in the Bhikkhuni Sutta, Ananda says that craving and conceit are to be abandoned by using, i.e. with the thought, I want to get enlightened. Craving and the thought, these other people are enlightened, I can get enlightened too. Conceit. Even stream winners, once returners and non-returners are yet to abandon these fetters. So when is craving and conceit useful in the practice and how does it fit in with the attitude of letting go? Yeah, you can sort of you know, use a bit of conceit and use a bit of craving, but it's a dangerous tool to use. It's like playing with fire. It can really burn you. Sometimes it can help you, like fire is useful for cooking your meal. An axe is good for sort of building hospitals, but also kill people, so it's a dangerous thing. But yeah, I want to get enlightened. A little bit of craving, I want to get enlightened. Okay, so that's enough. Now stop it. Yeah, you want to get enlightened. Now how do you get enlightened? Stop the craving. The conceit. Oh, I bet all the other meditators have at least got nimittas on this retreat. As for me, I've been sleeping not just in the first few days, what Ajahn Bum says, I've been sleeping all the last 7 or 8 days. There's only 2 to go. And I still feel sleepy. I still haven't even watched my breath for more than 4 breaths at a time. I'm really hopeless. And all these other people, they got far, 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 far ahead of me. So you think, so if I tell you that 1 or 2 people have got jhanas on this retreat, damn it, it's not me. Who are they? Let's have a look who they are. You go and beat them up afterwards. Yes. They're embarrassing you. So craving can sometimes help in a little way. You say, yeah, let's get enlightened. But then how do you become enlightened? Conceit. Yeah, I feel a bit embarrassed and I'm not making so much progress. But it's a dangerous path. So Ananda did that. Remember, he did that before he was enlightened, said that. So it's much, much, much better to use these letting goes. So it's not wrong, but there's a much better way. Ajahn Brahm, after your talk this morning, I somehow let go and I experienced the nothing you talk about. And it was bliss. There you go, another smart ass meditator. You've got somewhere. They got bliss. You had no bliss at all. That's really depressing. Anyway, great. And it was bliss. So this came about from your talk. Not meditation. Okay, so you came about through the talk, not meditation. Needless to say, I'm inspired. I'm walking in nature in the present moment. I had no need to chant, but putting in the ground work, both meditating, using the mantra, make peace, be kind, be gentle, be patient, works, etc. Yeah, of course it works. I knew that. So I think what you're saying here, that you were listening to a talk and that sort of inspired you and made you start letting go. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes you're listening to a talk, it really inspires you and you sort of you understand what's being said and you do some letting go. So sometimes if that happens, just shut your eyes and stop listening to the talk. You'd always catch it on the recording afterwards and you hear me so much. And the reason you talk like this is for people to get into those states. So if you are talking and you get into a nice state of nothing, just carry on. Forget about me talking. Because I'm just describing what you just experienced. So get into that nothing, and it is bliss. So enjoy, well done. Please, Ajahn, could you tell us more Ajahn Chah stories? One Ajahn Chah story. Ah, you know my favorite Ajahn Chah story. Favorite Ajahn Chah story, when I was in the back of the car with this novice from California, actually really New Mexico, Gary and Pabaco was in there, he was a translator, and Ajahn Chah in the front seat and a driver, and Ajahn Chah turned around to this young novice, Gary, and said, you're thinking of your girlfriend, aren't you? Ajahn Chah had read his mind. It's very dangerous to think of sex when Ajahn Chah was around. He'd catch you out every time. Yes, I was. I can fix that, said Ajahn Chah through the interpreter. Next time you write to your girlfriend back in the US, ask her to send something personal of hers so that if you really miss her, you can remember her. And he thought, wow, these Buddhist monks, they're romantic. Even Ajahn Chah, he understands about love and I miss my girlfriend. So what should I ask for, like a lock of her hair or a piece of her dress, you know, with her perfume on it. No, said Ajahn Chah, send her a bottle and ask for some of her shit. And then when you miss your girlfriend, you can open up the bottle. That's my loved one. That's Ajahn Chah, he was gross. But it's amazing, that's really amazing Dhamma. That's much better than anything you ever read in the Abhidhamma. Because that actually works. You know, why do you love somebody? Don't you actually say, you know, I love everything about you, my darling. Yeah, sure. The boys are the same, so if you really miss your boyfriend, just ask for some of his shit. So that's the sort of stories Ajahn Chah was up to. It seemed you were saying that Northeast Thai didn't experience grief, or was it just that they didn't express it? Surely any human will feel great sadness at loss, particularly of a child. Even animals have these feelings. I once saw a TV doc on elephants, and one was showing great distress over a stillborn calf, and all the other females came to support her and share her grief. That must have been a Christian elephant, because... It's true. They didn't. Look, I was 9 years in that place. And, you know, you go on arms round, you got to know all the villagers. And they chat to you about their life. And their monastery was a cremation ground. So they got burnt, you know, in our monastery. So you got to know everybody. And you saw them die, and children die. And you looked at them, and I never saw any sign of grief at all. And you talk with them. They couldn't have been just hiding it, because you saw them every day. That was actually a shock to me. Because I thought, this can't be. But it was. And the reason, I think, was because that was an indigenous Buddhist culture for generations and generations. And it hadn't been sort of infected by no TVs at that time. So they were just a pure ancient culture. Been doing that for... as long as they could remember. They just didn't have grief. Death just happens. Why be sad about it? It doesn't bring anybody back. So it's amazing to see that. Why isn't life force immediately relinquished after seeing the Dharma? Is it because of the craving to serve? What about Pacheka Buddhas? When you see the Dharma, you're just a stream winner. Okay, so you've seen the Dharma, but you've got all these habits from lifetimes before, and you've only just seen the Dharma once, so it takes a long time for that seeing the Dharma to percolate through your everyday life, so you change all your habits. Just like somebody, you know, has been smoking for a long time, and they know they've seen the evidence, they've seen their sort of their partner sort of die from lung cancer, they know it's going to kill them, but they just can't stop yet. It takes a while for that message to go deep inside and to stop their bad habits. So you all know that getting angry is a stupid thing to do. At least I hope you do. But can you stop it? No, just the habits. But you keep on sort of listening to these messages, and after a while it percolates through and the habit of anger disappears. Last night you said that when Hindus or Christians get first jhana, they interpret it as union with God. What happens when they get second jhana and above? Usually that's about as far as they get, the first jhana. Because union with God, they think they've made it. I was talking once to a fellow from Sydney who used to go to Swami Muktananda's ashram in the, somewhere up in the north of Sydney. And I said, what do they practice? Because he was like one of the most famous Hindu Swamis of, you know, at least of the late 20th century. And he said, oh, what they teach is you, you know, meditate just like us and you get this blue pearl nimitta. He said, once you emerge into that, that's it, you're a saint. That's samadhi. And they use the word samadhi, but samadhi was their enlightenment. And now when he said that, I could actually recognize what he was doing. And he sort of get into a nimitta, like a blue is a very common type of nimitta, pearl, beautiful. And it's just one nimitta out of many. And you merge into that, that would be a first jhana. So what they're really getting into is the first jhanas. If someone has never heard Buddhist teaching and does not have the framework of the three characteristics to interpret jhanas with, do they have no chance of enlightenment at all? Where does this leave non-Buddhists? Perhaps in the mystic traditions of other religions, do they have some teaching akin to Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta by some other name? Not really. It's because the anatta teaching was the killer, the one which really sort of got you into enlightenment. There's no other sort of teaching had that. You know, it's all, you know, there's a God, there's a soul. And you ever notice, where there's a God, there'll always be a soul. Where there's a soul, there'll be a God. So the God is the ultimate soul. And yeah, you can have it separate, you can be in the company of a God, or you can just emerge with God, which is a Brahmic idea. And this is what happens when you sort of get into the jhana. You just merge with bliss, with power, with ultimate love. That's what it feels like. So, but that's only a jhana. If you go deeper, you start to disappear. So it's only the Buddhists actually said, no self. And even these days, you see some modern Buddhists, they try and interpret that. I mean, there's one even monk, who's a quite well-known Western monk, who said, no, it's not a teaching, it's a strategy. You know, it's not really true. It's not to be sort of believed in. It's just a way, it's a good thing to sort of believe in because it's going to get you to the real truth. And, you know, even, I don't mind sort of upsetting people, even to some of the forest monks, they think there's an original mind, this essential mind. So when you sort of get to enlightenment, you merge with this original mind and that's the end. You know, but you're still there. You're with the original mind. There's no real cessation. And that's not Buddhism. That is actually Hinduism. So I get into trouble for saying that because there's some famous monks who say that sort of stuff. But if you really want to find out, have a look in Brahmajala Sutta, 63 wrong views, and you find a mind, a jitta, which is permanent, is wrong view number 8. You even know which wrong view it is, it's number 8. So have a look in there, you can see for yourself, it's wrong view. Yeah. Yeah. Indeed, yes. Yeah, they go round and round and round and round and round and round, indeed. Because once you think you exist, you can't cease. You can't let go of yourself. Just, it's an impossible thing to do. The best simile was from Oliver Twist, where one of the characters in there, I think they gave this character's best friend gave Oliver Twist a £5 to go and pay his bill at the bookshop. And so this Oliver Twist went off with a £5 note to pay the bill, and his mate said, that's a stupid thing to give this little urchin all that money. He's not going to bring it back. He said, yes he will. He said, no he won't. Yes he will. If he brings it back, said his character, I'll eat my own head. Can you eat your own head? So think about it. How are you going to do that? It's totally impossible because you need a mouth to eat the head, and the mouth is part of the head. You can't eat your own head. And it's the same way. Once you've got a sense of self, you can't destroy yourself. It is like eating your own head. That's why when there's a sense of self, it will keep on going. So the first thing is to see there's no one there. Once you've seen that, everything else is easy. So that's why those Buddhist traditions, or anyone else who has this idea of a non-self, they can get enlightened. Dhirajan, how does one know he or she are already Sotapanna, stream venturer? Do we need jhana to be a Sotapanna? You can't know you're a... Well, you can think you know you're a stream winner, but all of these ones, you certainly can know you're not. But sometimes you can't know you are. So what do you want to be a stream winner for? That's just more attainment, it's more ego. So just disappear and forget about all these things. The sign says to get up with gusto. What is gusto? Oh no. Oh no. sorry, I read that wrong. The sign says to get up with gusto. What if gusto doesn't want to get up at 4 a.m? And what's gusto doing in my room anyway? That's a very good question. Good old gusto. Dearest Ajahn, how do you maintain our faith in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha? Thanks. Come to meditation retreats. Then you get lots of faith in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You get really nice Sangha. Look at the beautiful nuns and monks here. And the Dharma, the teaching inspires you. And the Buddha, just this wisdom. Brilliant. Please explain Bhavanga state and how to differentiate from jhana. I've heard it's easy to get into Bhavanga and mistake it for jhana. Okay, Bhavanga is just a thing which the Abhidharma started to sort of think about, and it just means absolutely unconscious and you're not really aware at all. Jhana, you're fully aware. Bhavanga, you're just unconscious. Dear Ajahn, I am a lesbian feminist who hates men. This is an interesting question. I still live with my husband. I told him no more sex. I stay with him because he earns good money. My husband didn't agree to not have sex. I have many erotic girlfriends. Am I breaking the third precept? Many thank yous. Well, yeah, probably are breaking the third precept, but it's being pretty stupid. Sort of, okay, you're a lesbian feminist, fine, but having many erotic girlfriends, I mean, if you really want to get enlightened, you know, just let all of that sort of sensory pleasure stuff disappear. You wonder which one it is. Who is it? Who says it? No. It's the best thing to do is, again, the lesbian feminist who hates men, still with my husband, I told him no more sex. I stay with him because he earns good money. My husband didn't agree not to have sex. It's a bit unfair on him. So, you know, if that's who you are, this obviously would be a good thing to free your husband so he can find a partner if he really wants to. So out of compassion for him. And if you have many erotic girlfriends, it's maybe when you first start playing around, that's what you want. But after a while, most people find that just having one partner is, you know, enough instead of sort of having many, many, many. Because it's not just the sensuality. There's something more you want in relationships, which is a bit of like intimacy which can last rather than just for short term. And then eventually, if you really want to sort of get into deep meditation, you find that just any of that eroticism, it just takes you into the body. And it's very hard to leave that body and go into deep meditation. And really, if you really want to have some fun and joy, the bliss in deep meditation is far better than sex. And if you don't believe me, just try it and find out. So that's what I was actually saying. The third precept, yeah, if you have that relationship with your husband, you are his husband, it's a good thing to probably, you know, end that relationship, or at least give him freedom to say, look, you know, don't regard me as your wife. If you want to get another sort of partner, please do so. That's what I would do anyway. Not that I would know. I've been a monk for the last 36 years, so really I shouldn't have answered that question at all. I'm totally ill-informed. Dear Ajahn, during the course of the last... Why do people ask monks questions like that? Anyway. During the course of the last 6 days of the retreat, I faced all five hindrances. Today I faced sensual pleasures, lust, one that I found very hard to find peace with. Tried peace, kind and gentle, also tried to contemplate the impermanent nature of thoughts. I was expecting a peaceful afternoon of meditation. This morning was peaceful. I learned not to expect anything. I remember one of the monks, he's a well-known monk, but I won't say who it was. He was staying in this monastery where they would do 2 hours of meditation every evening. It was just standard practice. And he was a young monk, and, you know, he was hot, and he was tired, and his knees ached, and he was suffering most of those two-hour meditations. But one time, he decided, no, let's think of sex. And so he had this fantasy. And the 2 hours passed like a couple of seconds. No pain in the legs, no pain in the back. But then when it finished and the bell went, he thought, uh-oh. Because that teacher could read minds. And he thought, I'm in big trouble. Especially when the teacher came right up to him, stood up and looked over him. And he thought, what's he going to say? And the teacher said, you've just been wasting 2 hours, and walked away. No punishment, but just a very, very wonderful saying. You've just wasted a couple of hours of your time. So that's all it is. If you have the sexual fantasies or sensual pleasures, lust, you're just wasting time, that's all. So when you see that, you don't get guilty or down upon yourself. You say, look, I'm on a meditation retreat. You know, if you want to sort of have lust, sensual pleasures, do that when you leave. This is meditation. You can really develop something beautiful. So after a while, you look at those things and what a waste of time. Dear Ajahn, can you talk about Teflon mind and how to attain this? Like this, and you've got someone who's got a pan hitting their head. So, a nice sort of cartoon. So anyway, it's a nice cartoon on there. Have a look at the cartoon. Very nice. The Teflon mind is you learn how to let go. You don't have anything stick to you. You don't have to try to remember all these things and to write them all down. I think, I must remember that. That was really profound. Just drop it all. You remember it naturally. So that's having a Teflon mind, a very easy mind. It's like that simile of my mother's mantel shelf where you put one thing on at a time, and when you want to put another thing, throw the other thing off. So you've only got one thing in your mind. So nothing sticks to it. You don't keep things. You don't think, oh, this is important. I have to keep this one. Nothing is important except emptiness. So throw everything away, and then your mind becomes naturally Teflon. So nothing sticks to you at all. And then you're free. Hi, Ajahn, you say we cannot change the cause and effect. Did I? I'll change that. Yes, we cannot change past cause and effects, but isn't cultivating virtue and observe the five precepts now is in some way changing our old habits, hence changing cause and effect for the future? Can you please clarify this point? Thank you. Yes, sort of change the cause and effect. What do you mean, change the cause and effect? Okay, the cause and effect, this is this process which happens, and you think you're changing it, but that's part of the cause and effect. So you're part of nature, so you're not separate from nature, standing outside controlling it. You're part of it. So cultivating virtue and observing the five precepts, you've got no choice. You have to. It's all been caused by all the wonderful teachers you've had. And that's the effect. You have to keep those five precepts. So sometimes you ask, why do I keep five precepts? I'll tell you why. You've been brainwashed too. I've been hypnotized you. You must keep five precepts. You must keep five precepts. You must keep five. That's why I keep. So, sometimes you ask, why do I do these things? If it really was you cultivating these five precepts, who was it who decided to cultivate five precepts? Was it really free choice? When you go into a shop to buy your muesli, why do you choose that type of muesli and not another type of muesli? Is it really free choice? Could you really do anything different? Ask the advertisers. If it really was free choice, there'd be no money at all to be made in advertising. Advertising works because it convinces you to buy something without you realizing it. I first found that out when I was at university. I remember seeing this advert on television for Saint Bruno Tobacco. I'll never forget it. Because on this advert, they had this ordinary looking guy, not particularly big or athletic looking or handsome, this ordinary looking guy. And he was walking down the street of some nondescript English town. And nothing was happening, but then he took out his pipe. And he put in St. Bruno tobacco and lit it. And the aroma wafted into this newsagent. He just passed by. And behind the counter of the newsagent was this drop-dead gorgeous girl. And as soon as she smelt it, she was totally entranced, jumped over the counter and followed this guy, waiting for his command. And then he passed the greengrocer's shop and another beautiful redhead, like a supermodel. She too smelt St. Bruno tobacco. She was so entranced that she too left the shop, again waiting, what do you want me to do? I'm yours. And then after, it's a great advert, after about 1 minute, had this whole line of incredibly beautiful young ladies following him. St. Bruno tobacco, irresistible to the opposite sex. That's stupid, isn't it? I mean, who would believe an advert like that? I did. I got a Bruno tobacco. But you know, when I lit it up, it didn't work. You know, it was even an ordinary looking girl walked back and past the shop. She never jumped out and followed me. Now, you get caught as well many times. So that's why this advertising, we think that we're so sophisticated it doesn't affect us. Yes, it does. So be careful, just how you get influenced. Next question, your emptiness. I was surprised to hear about monks using snuff and Ajahn Chah smoking. Is smoking a bad karma? What is specific for the precept regarding intoxicants? It's usually like narcotics, things which dull the awareness, which is why tea and coffee was allowed for monks. That was actually one of the wonderful things which could make me become a monk, especially when I heard there was a monk called Ajahn Chah. And I thought, Chah, that means tea. That's just the right monk for someone from England. So tea and coffee were allowed, but sort of snuff and smoking, because it's a stimulant, that was allowed. Stimulants were allowed. But it's only because later on they found out that snuff and smoking was actually bad for your health. That's why we stopped it. Well, that's bad for your health because you end up in jail.
But it's not intoxicant?
It's not intoxicant, no, sir. That's an interesting question. Would it be against the five precepts? It's certainly not a wise thing to do because it does have bad health effects, so I've heard. And I must admit that when I was a kid, teenager, there was so many drugs around in London. And most of my friends, we went to a top school in West London, you know, because of scholarships. And most of my friends got into drugs, a real big time. And one of my best friends, he went to Cambridge with me studying medicine in Sydney, Sussex. He had to leave after 2 years. He was starting to steal from the medical cabinet. He was a heroin addict. And it was just a great shame. I saw him a few years ago. And he got a job just mowing lawns in gardens. A brilliant guy, and because of that heroin, started off with marijuana, but you know, that sort of idea, I said, no, it doesn't start with one drug, doesn't lead on to other things. It did. And I was really fortunate. The only reason why I never got into those drugs was my father was so sick. I remember being with one of my best friends who'd been smoking marijuana and got caught, and he said, my life at home is just crazy. My father is so upset at me. And I thought, gee, if my father caught me smoking drugs, that would kill him, literally. Because he was on the edge of life and death. One more thing like that would just probably push him over the edge. And I just couldn't do that to my father. So when I was at school, I resisted just out of concern for him. And when I got to university, then I started meditating, and the teacher said, no drugs. So that was actually what kept me off them. Otherwise, I'd have probably got into them as well, because all my peers were getting into them. Yeah, indeed, and you know, it's dangerous to them. It certainly does, again, open your perception to be able to see amazing things, but you can do that just with deep meditation. You don't need to have the chemicals in you. And it's far more, in a sense, sort of gentle in meditation. That's why, you know, you can see like Ajahn Brahm sort of laying down, smiling in bliss next to a crystal waterfall, you know. Brilliant sort of like LSD experiences, but more subtle and more soft. And it's also, this ain't illegal. And you don't get into excesses.
I was told by a Tibetan monk that the actual translation of that precept is just alcohol.
Sura Maria Maja. It's also Sura Maria Maja. It's other things as well. It's mostly alcohol, but it's really things which are the cause for heedlessness. Yeah, it's the heedlessness thing which is the most important for Madhutana. But yeah, it's Sura Maria Maja. No, it actually means more than just alcohol. The Maja part would include other things as well. So Maja is the intoxicants, things which cause intoxicant, that word means. Sura Maria means like the alcohol part. Yeah, that's right, yeah, you've got to sort of balance it. So, because I was brought up, and as soon as I came off, you know, the mother's milk, you're into tea as an English person. So it's, you know, just sort of thing, I've given it out for a few times and just make sure I'm not attached to it. But yeah, I usually take some tea. So balance it. If you take too much, you're going to stuff your brain. So just balance it. The last question, then we have to do some more of these questions, otherwise we'll be here till too late. Yes.
In terms of the Sangha and smoking, it doesn't give rise, doesn't give faith to lay people. Once I heard you say, oh, yeah, if you see someone, they have an addiction, if they can't give that up, then, how could they give up their other defilements?
That's right. That's what a lot of people have said. If they see a monk smoking or a nun smoking, they think, gee, if they can't give up something which is obviously bad for your health and which the whole lay people give up easily, what can they give up? So, again, you lose faith in the monks if they smoke. Ajahn still believe that some hard work and effort earns credit, which pays off in results later. If being so gentle with yourself is the way, then why persist in getting up at an ungodly hour of 4 a.m.? Because we don't believe in God, so it's not ungodly anymore. Maybe in Thailand, because of feet, even so, 3 a.m. is nuts. But why here? Also, many great teachers, e.g. Ajahn Mun, look like they've had years of grim determination, all-night sits. Now, the all-night sits was started by Ajahn Chah, but in those monasteries, they don't have all-night sits, except if you're enjoying yourself. So in those types of monasteries, they were gentle, they were kind, and again, you get Ajahn Mahabhur's take on Ajahn Mun. If you ask some of the other monks who were there, Ajahn Mun was this very kind, incredibly gentle, laughing monk. So you get a different picture of these monks. And Ajahn Chah was incredibly gentle and kind and laughing. So sometimes what you read in the books, is what the monk should be, and the tough guy who fights tigers, who stands in there and is eaten by mosquitoes, but he just sits there. Sits there in the middle of biting ants, has snakes crawl all over them. They're the real monks, because people are reading stories like that, so your biography sells. If you say the monk just said, oh, you're just nice and peaceful and kind and gentle, you just got up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And of course, that's not inspiring for many people, because they have idea the more ascetic, the more the better it is as a spiritual practice. But I've seen that, done it myself, and it does not work. So getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, just because you like getting up at that time, not because you have to. So that's why I get up at that time, because I enjoy it. It's nice. I love the early mornings meditating. If you don't enjoy it, then don't get up. So you don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's optional to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning in this retreat. You can always get up earlier if you want to. That's the only option. Okay. Thank you to the lady with the be kind on the back of her shirt. It was a happy reminder. Someone's got on a t-shirt, be kind. Paritta Gosa Paritta chanting. Is there a link between the meaning of these two words? Gosa means this does mean, that's with a G-H-O-S-A, that does mean speaking. And paritta is just protection. So speaking protection, speaking chanting, yes, it is pretty much the same meaning. Last question, because it's getting late. And if those who want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, naturally, you better go to bed soon. Who needs Estee Lauder or Revlon or Lynx products? Anyone looking at the radiant faces of Ajahn Wayama and Brahm can see that beautiful complexion is a result of the happiness through meditation and non-clinging. So if you stay here, this is like getting makeover. This is like sort of having a beautiful face all done for you, like beauty parlor. That's why I've often said, this is not Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center, it is Jhana Grove Salon. Where even the boys go back with a better complexion. So your husband or your partner will be, or the lady with the feminist lesbian, all your erotic girlfriends will think, wow, you look so beautiful after you've been on this meditation retreat. I've heard of Estee Lauder and Revlon, but Lynx, is that another sort of...
It's actually, you were describing the Bruno thing.
Oh, yeah. Follow you if you have links to the other one. Okay. It won't work. Okay, so that way. And why do the monks and the nuns' faces look relaxed? Because we let go of all our worries. Even though I'm sitting in front of all of you and you're watching me and watching sister all the time, we don't care what we look like. Because we don't care what we look like, that's why we get radiant. So you don't worry about what you look like. You just make your mind calm, peaceful, kind and gentle. And then your mind, your face will be radiant. So that's what you need to do. Easy. So I think that's enough for tonight. I don't know about you, but I'm tired. Lots and lots of questions. And did it really help at all? Do you really understand what Nibbana is now, or what will is, and what the other stuff we were talking about? But nice entertainment anyway. Better than meditating, some people say. So anyway, the night is still young. For those who aren't getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, if you think 4 o'clock in the morning is an ungodly hour, what does 9:24 in the evening feel like? The night is still young. So those of you who like getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you can go to bed now. Those of you who are night people, then carry on meditating. The night is still young. It's cool. It's peaceful. And if you want to have beautiful complexion, stay meditating. So you don't get it from beauty sleep. You get it from beauty meditating. If you want to go to bed, go to bed. Okay, enough. And remember, tomorrow night's questions are for the sisters, because I'll be at Dhammaloka giving a talk over there. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And remember, don't let them get away easily tomorrow night. Nice, tough questions. Is that all right? Yeah, you're up to it.